From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Dow plunged more than 1,000 points at opening today over fears of the global spread of COVID-19, the disease caused by the new coronavirus. South Korea's president called its new cases 231 today, unprecedented and powerful. The total there is 833. In Italy, there are 142 cases. Also today, the World Health Organization, the WHO, held a press conference. Dr. Michael Ryan, executive director of the WHO's emergency program, said the spread of COVID-19 is not a pandemic, but also said the world isn't ready for a pandemic. We're still trying to avoid that reality, avoid that eventuality, he said. What does that mean? Let's bring back Larry Gostin, a professor of global health law at Georgetown and director of the WHO's Center on Global Health. Larry, professor, start with that statement. It's not a pandemic yet. Many people may not even know what a pandemic is. So what does that statement mean?
I mean, it's actually quite meaningless. In the same statement, Mike Ryan said that we have to foresee that we're not going to be able to contain this very easily, or if not at all. Whether you define it as a pandemic is just a form of terminology. WHO doesn't even have power to declare a pandemic. The key here is that there are appearing to be sustained community transmissions in Asia, in Europe, and also in Iran. We're on the precipice of a major spread globally.
You're saying kind of forget that word, because why? We should be concerned anyway, regardless?
Yes, we should be concerned anyway. And, you know, whether it meets the threshold of a pandemic or not, it would not surprise me if it were an all-out pandemic fairly soon. But remember, we shouldn't panic, because pandemics can affect different places in different ways. The United States is highly capable. Our state and local health departments, the U.S. CDC, is literally the best in the world. It is possible for us to contain it. And also remember, it's not a highly fatal disease. We shouldn't overreact.
When we spoke to you in early February, you were a voice warning against those massive quarantines. You said they don't work. We watched as people were quarantined on ships. It didn't work. What are some other things you're observing that you think people can be doing? Let's be proactive.
Sure. But let me just comment, because you're so right. We're seeing these outbreaks in hospitals, prisons, nursing homes, churches, anywhere that people congregate. And so the best thing we can do is follows. I mean, certainly use personal hygiene, wash your hands frequently, don't go near somebody who's sick. If you're sick, either stay home or see a doctor immediately. From the public health point of view, what we need to do is be really rigorous in finding everybody that's got flu-like symptoms that could be COVID-19. And ask them to be isolated or quarantined in their own homes.
Well, how do we do that, Larry? Because if somebody's got a flu-like symptom in the middle of Italy, and they don't know who the ground zero patient there was yet, they don't quite know who brought the infection into the country. So every single person, because nobody knows who's been in contact with somebody who may or may not have symptoms of it, every single person needs to be tested who has a flu symptom?
Well, if they have a flu symptom, yes, they should be tested. But you're making an important insight. There is a point where you can contain an outbreak the way I've suggested. So in the United States, for example, health departments have a pretty good idea who's infected, who's been exposed. But there comes a point, and the point may have passed in Italy. It may certainly has passed in Iran, Korea, where you can't do that. And then you just have to go to what's public health people call mitigation, you know, trying to temporarily close down major congregate events, you know, big sporting events, or you may even have to close schools for a short period of time. Mm-hmm. These things can delay it, but ultimately, if this is a fast-moving epidemic, we're probably not going to be able to do it, and we're going to have to race for a vaccine.
And the race is on for a vaccine. So you say certain moments, you know, keeping people contained in their homes, for instance, some of those moments have passed maybe in Italy and Iran. What can they be doing if the moment has passed? Or is there something you're seeing in other countries outside of the quarantines that they shouldn't be doing?
My big worry is that you've got it in Iran, in a region that is, you know, highly unstable. You know, imagine foreseeability that it will go to Syria or Afghanistan or sub-Saharan Africa where you have weak health systems. Once that happens, I think, you know, we're really on the precipice of something really particularly bad.
We're seeing people in Syria, they don't have food or shelter. And so what would be not fatal, perhaps, in another population would be fatal there.
Absolutely. When you have people that are vulnerable, that are suffering from, you know, respiratory and other kinds of infectious diseases, or you're going to have many more deaths. What I'd like to see is for the United States to lead, just the way we did with Ebola in West Africa, where President Obama sought a $1 billion plus emergency fund.
That's Larry Gostin, professor of global health law at Georgetown University, director of the World Health Organization Center on Global Health. Professor, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
As we just heard, fears of COVID-19 are infecting stock markets around the world today. Let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, business analyst for CBS News and host of Jill on Money. She's tracking that part of the story. Jill, welcome.
Thank you.
And it's not just here in the United States where the Dow fell more than 1,000 points today at one point. The markets were way off sharply in Italy, Germany, the UK, South Korea. What are you seeing? What's going on?
Well, you know, I think this really developed over the course of the weekend. Last week when I spoke to large investors, there was sort of consensus that, look, we know growth is going to take a hit in China, maybe a tiny bit in the globe, but this seems to be contained. It seems to be that cases, new reported cases are slowing down. But then we hear a bunch of cases in South Korea, in Italy, as well as in Iran. And now all of a sudden, there's a new story that's developing. What if this is worse than we thought? What if the spread is not so easily contained? What if a already somewhat weakened Europe tips into a recession as a result of this? These are the conversations that I've been having this morning. It's why, as you say, markets are off about 3.5% here in the United States.
You know, look, for some days and over the last couple of weeks, we have seen markets fall because there was some concern about that, about the virus. We saw that happen with Apple when it lowered its revenue outlook for March. But for the most part, as you say, investors have sort of shrugged this off. But at what point do you think we're at a risk for a real correction in the stock market because of the virus?
You know, usually when you have a correction or the start of selling in the middle of a bull run, it happens for something that's completely unforeseen. Now, sure, that could be something that happens with the central bank. It could be that you thought that the Fed was going to do something. The Fed's not going to do something. But this is something that investors call an exogenous event, something that happens way outside the scope of what most people would consider. And so you think about a natural disaster or something like this where you can't get your arms around it. Now, I should say that when the G20 got together this weekend, they released reports saying, hey, you know, we think the growth in China is going to be down by 0.4%, a tenth of a percent across the globe. Those are not huge numbers. In fact, a lot of the analysts I talked to think it's going to be worse than that. But what I think you're starting to understand is that sometimes selling can be quite emotional. And this does not mean that we are all, you know, emotional animals all the time. But as you see the selling develop over the evening session last night, I could tell there was an acceleration. And now we're seeing that come to fruition. Could it be the beginning of something? Sure. But could we wake up tomorrow morning and people say, wait a second, we're not in this for the short term. It's a long term event.
Well, you're right. Fear tends to be the thing that drives wild swings, at least initially, in the stock market. And we're going to find out how badly the new coronavirus is actually hurting the global economy. But the U.S. Federal Reserve, we know it's keeping a close eye on this. What might it do? Could it step in and intervene if there's a larger outbreak?
There is no doubt in my mind that we should take Jerome Powell, the chairman of the Fed, at his word that they are monitoring the situation. If the Federal Reserve officials begin to see growth slide in the United States, and I would think this would have to be a substantial slowdown, not just a slowdown in a certain sector, but something more pervasive where growth, instead of being at 2%, comes in maybe below 1% in the first quarter. That's when the Fed is likely to act. I think that it is almost without question that the Fed is going to cut rates if it sees growth slide. They said as much in their last meeting, and certainly Jerome Powell said that when he testified before Congress recently. So yes, the Fed will step in. Doesn't mean the Fed can stop markets from falling, at least in the short term.
A couple other things I'm watching today. U.S. oil futures fell 5% on reduced demand. Investors were piling into gold, a sort of a safe haven. And then look what happened in Milan. Several events at the Fashion Week shut down there. Milan is a financial center in Italy. Just briefly, what will you be watching for in the next several days?
Well, I think that in Italy we should keep an eye on the fact that this is northern Italy, and you know about 30 to 40% of Italian GDP is in that region. So that's something that's very important. Keep our eyes on tourism, on exports, on manufacturing and supply chains. So there we're going to be looking at not just China, but Japan and Vietnam. And Singapore, all these areas are going to be impacted, and obviously so are we.
Jill Schlesinger with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thanks so much.
Great to be with you.
Each of us is the star in the movie of our life. But how much of a role do we play in other people's movies?
It was a really sort of palpable fear that they were going to reject me or worse.
The unseen pressures we place on other people this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Lifestyle icon Barbara B. Smith, or B as she was affectionately called by her many fans, passed away Saturday after a heroic public battle with early onset Alzheimer's. B. Smith was one of the first African-American models on the cover of Mademoiselle, then an entrepreneur, an A-list restaurateur with cookbooks, a magazine, home products, a syndicated TV show, B. Smith with Style, on which she glowed.
"'Tis the season to be stylish."
Since this is our last show before the holidays, we put together a sampler of our most beautiful seasonal ideas to share with you. Sensational centerpieces, glorious gift wrappings, terrific table settings.
But then things went very dark. Bea was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. She and her husband, Dan Gasby, a respected producer, wrote a book early on, Before I Forget, Love, Hope, Help, and Acceptance in Our Fight Against Alzheimer's, to get the word out that African Americans are twice as likely to get Alzheimer's as whites, and women are more likely to get it than men. But when Dan revealed, as Bea was fading, that he'd begun dating, he was vilified. Dan is not doing interviews today. Bea's death is too recent. But we thought our conversation from last June says so much about living with Alzheimer's. As it began, he was already speaking of B in the past tense.
We had a relationship that we called a real 40. You know, in business, if you've got 40% of anything, you basically have a major stake, but you don't control. And we built the business around B. I was in television. I had done a lot of different things. But when we got together and she wanted to put on her first TV show, and after she wrote her first book, she came to me and said, "Would you help me?" And I said, "Of course." It's tough, Robin, because for 27 years, we operated as two as one. Then one day you suddenly realize that you're looking at a person who can't talk to you with their eyes, and no matter how much you love them, things are sort of like a railroad track. If it's parallel, it goes on to infinity. But if a little bit is off, the further down the tracks you go, the farther it is away from parallel. And that's what happened with us. It derailed by virtue of us not being able to communicate.
Do I understand still caring for her, still altogether, still in
my,
the home?
Robin, my biggest fear is that I die before her. We talked about the what ifs. She didn't want to be, as we talked about it, a can of corn, and I didn't want to be a can of corn. We wrote those things out in our wills, you know, about end-of-life proxies and things of that sort, which most people don't do, and I have to be candid with you, most African-Americans don't even want to talk about, because we have a tendency to think life is optional and death is optional.
Can you stay for a second, Dan, on just how difficult it is? And again, you know, you guys have means. We were just joking, and you said, you know, in some ways, in this beautiful home out on Long Island, you're sometimes kind of a prisoner along with her. She's imprisoned by the disease, but you're there too. You have to. How much do you have to do to safeguard her now?
It's a 24/7, 365 effort that you have to always be cognizant of, because at any given time, she could either walk away, she could eat something. Like, I'll give you a perfect example. The housekeeper uses Fabuloso, and Fabuloso looks like grape soda. Mm-hmm. And so we have to be careful that we don't leave any detergents or soaps, because, you know, if you blink, she can take it. Mm. And quite honestly, Robin, what most people don't understand, whether you have means or not, the emotional toll is unbelievable. It takes everything out of you to see someone who is vibrant and brilliant and caring suddenly be reduced to not being able to understand anything.
Yeah.
It literally robs the person of their humanness, and they basically become a mammal.
Alzheimer's didn't just take Bee's memory of our 27 years together. It would often make her irrational and moody, you've said. She would sometimes lash out at you. And
Yeah. See, here's the thing. You talk to anyone who really understands the disease, the person is gone. Mm. They don't know their mother or their father. They don't know their children.
Does she know you?
She calls me daddy, or she'll call me her ex-husband's name before we met. You know, the caregiver basically is in a no-win situation. Everybody can have judgments, but they don't sit there at 3 o'clock in the morning and have to clean up after somebody went to the bathroom in the bed or on the floor. Nobody wants to talk about having to change somebody, or every time you bathe them, it's like a kabuki dance, trying to get them to take their clothes off and to clean them. Bee understood that. We talked about this.
Let's go to, you know, what you're referring to. With this loneliness that you've been describing, watching Bee Smith disappear, you met another woman in the area who was caring at the time for her father who was dying. She's a white woman that raised hackles. Her name is Alex. You became comrades in that, both being caregivers, and then you fell in love. And now she is your girlfriend, and now she is helping you and your daughter take care of Bee Smith. And at first, when you shared this information, you know, you were thinking, oh, I have this respite. I want people to know that you can maybe have this kind of a respite. But the backlash was furious. What do you want people to know?
I wish the role was reversed and Bee was doing the same thing. I'd want her to be happy. You know, before you're black, you're a person. You're a human being. And it has taught me one thing about judgments and about people. The average person makes a judgment without any real knowledge.
You also want people to know that you and Barbara Bee talked about what, you know, you each would want. And she told you what? She wanted you to have a life if hers started to fade.
She said to me, I know what this is. I know where it's going to take me. I want you to live your life. And what's so arguably sad is how telling the truth has created such a furor among people who have no clue who Bee Smith is.
But just start with a woman. Are you hearing from people saying, how can you have another woman in your life when your wife is not gone yet?
Of course I'm hearing that. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying that I don't have a wife. I hid this for 5 years, and then I came out with this for 5 years, and I'm not going to let myself die in the name of what somebody else feels is right. So to have a situation where you can spend time with someone, you can share moments with someone, for people who want to do that, God bless them. But, you know, I've studied this, I understand, and there are thousands and tens of thousands of people. I get calls all the time from people who says, thank you, for almost like coming out of the closet. Mm-hmm. Alex understood when we got into this relationship that, you know, just like if you have two kids and I fall in love with you, Robin, you know what? I don't get you and the kids are optional. You get the package. Alex does not live in my house. She has a room that she can put her stuff in. But most importantly, Robin, I did this because I saw how the African-American community in particular is dealing with a tsunami that is going to impact them over the next 20 years.
Well, when you say that's why you did this, you mean speaking out because of this wave that's going to hit African Americans. You've called this a 21st century civil rights issue.
Absolutely. Civil rights issue. It's an existential threat to the wealth and well-being of African Americans, and particularly the most predominant part of the African American community that has made the fastest gains, and that's women.
Look, you've called for a greater investment in research, education about diet and exercise habits that might stem this disease, research into why it's more affecting the African-American community. It could be because they are more susceptible to things like hypertension, cardiovascular disease. There might be some genetic markers. And you're calling on African-Americans to be a part of medical trials, which historically many are afraid of.
We're afraid of them because of Tuskegee, and we have to get over Tuskegee.
Yet this was the infamous government study of black men with syphilis, which did not treat them for the disease. Yeah.
My concern, quite honestly, is that in 2040, they will have found ways to mitigate Alzheimer's for vast swaths of the population. But because black folks are afraid of participating in drug trials, we're right where we were in 2000. That's my biggest concern. And I started to read and see how we're so afraid of dealing with the future and looking at things from a different perspective. That's what Bea understood. And she said, let's tell the story.
And it sounds like what you're saying to the African-American community is to take a clear-eyed look at what they may want, because statistically, they are going to, a huge number is going to be in the same situation you're in.
You know what? You can have faith in God, but you also have to believe in math. And math says that if we're twice as likely and we are over-indexing and hypertension, we got a better chance of having Alzheimer's and all forms of dementia. And the only thing I'm trying to do is say, pay attention.
Yeah. Dan Gaspy, the former television executive who is the husband of Bea Smith, former model, restaurateur, just what a force of nature. Dan, thanks so much for talking to us. We wish you the best.
Robin, thank you for having me, and I appreciate you.
Our conversation from last June with Dan Gaspy, now the widower of Bea Smith, who died Saturday. His statement today reads, "Thank you to all the friends and fans who supported Bea and our family during her journey. Heaven is shining even brighter now that it's graced with Bea's dazzling and unforgettable smile."
In New York City today, a jury has found disgraced movie producer Harvey Weinstein guilty on 2 felony counts of sex crimes. He was acquitted on more serious charges, including 2 counts of predatory sexual assault. The verdict comes after the jury spent 5 days deliberating and more than a year and a half after Weinstein turned himself over to the Manhattan police. The Manhattan district attorney who brought the charges, Cyrus Vance, said this after the verdict was announced.
My hope is, with this verdict, survivors of sexual assault, whether it's of Mr. Weinstein or whether it's of someone else, will come forward, and our office and others like our office will, I hope, be there to listen to them and to help them move forward.
NPR Arts editor Rose Friedman joins us now from New York City with the latest. And Rose, the jury found Weinstein guilty of a criminal sexual act in the first degree and rape in the third degree. What's the significance of that verdict today?
The jury did not find him guilty on those 2 predatory sexual assault charges that you mentioned. So those were the most serious ones. Those could come with a life sentence. They did find him guilty of the ones you mentioned. But, you know, in a larger sense, this case really came down to whether or not the jury believed the 3 women who were part of these charges. It, you know, there wasn't a lot of physical evidence in the case. So it really just came down to whether or not the jury found these stories credible. And so what the jury is indicating with this verdict is that they found the stories of Miriam Haley and Jessica Mann, the 2 women who were in the charges, they found those 2 women credible. The woman who they're basically saying they didn't find credible was actress Annabella Shura, who was brought in to sort of bolster those predatory sexual assault charges. And that was a big surprise because she was widely seen as the prosecution's strongest witness. So that was sort of surprising to everybody in there. But you know, the significance is that they believed these 2 women, who both of whom kept in contact with Weinstein after these assaults were said to have happened. So that was a big question in this case.
You mentioned the name of at least three women who had testified during this trial, accused him of sexual assault and rape. Just to remind us how intense and emotional this trial has been.
Yeah. So there were three women in the charges, but six women testified altogether. It was part of a strategy that was also used in the Bill Cosby case to bring in more women. And, you know, the stories were really harrowing. They were often hard to listen to. They were quite graphic. In her closing argument, the prosecutor, Jonah Luzzi, portrayed Harvey Weinstein as a predator who would go after women who were really vulnerable and who really didn't have very much, either very much money or very much stature. She described them as ants he could step on. And, you know, the defense tried to poke holes in that. They tried to say these women are lying, that they're, you know, reframing consensual encounters later after the fact as non-consensual. But yeah, that was sort of the tenor of the trial.
The important context here is that this was the case that kicked off the Me Too movement across the United States. So we will see, you know, as this news develops here and we get reaction from the victims, we'll see what that means for the movement. But just quickly, do we have any idea what the sentence will be?
Yeah. One of the charges carries up to 25 years. The other carries up to 4 years. And then after that, he's still facing charges in Los Angeles.
NPR's Rose Friedman, thanks so much.
Thank you.
In August of 2014, a 911 call was made in Bladen County, North Carolina.
He's a black male subject.
Hanging from the swing.
Oh, God, Daddy. Oh, Lord.
That black male was 17-year-old Lennon Lacey. Authorities told his mom, Claudia, he killed himself. After a review, the FBI agreed. But the area had a history of young black men found hanging. His friends and family didn't believe he'd taken his life. His mom spent much of hers trying to get that decision reversed.
Think about it as if it was your son or your daughter. If you knew in your heart and in your mind that someone took your child's life, and everything that you've done is humanly possible, they taken it and twisted it and turned it, how far would you go to get to the truth?
And that is the focus of the documentary Always in Season, which premieres on PBS's Independent Lens tonight and tells the story of Lennon Lacey's death, but also widens that lens to the history of lynching. Director, co-writer Jacqueline Olive joins us now from the NPR West Studios in Culver City, California. Jackie, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And the first thing I have to mention is you are African-American. I can't imagine sitting with some of the despicable footage of lynchings that you must have been going over and over in edit rooms. I mean, much of this is crushing.
It's tough. As a black mother, my son was Lennon's age when I learned about his death. My son was also 17. And so as a black mother, I'd been having conversations with him that were very general about protecting himself and about racism and racial violence. I could imagine that those were the same conversations that Claudia had with Lennon. And in fact, when we met, she talked about that, about how they had spoken about Trayvon Martin's death and cautioning Lennon about wearing hoodies. And so in all of those ways, I could relate to the pain that Claudia must be feeling. I could imagine it. And then there were the depths that I could not imagine. I couldn't imagine what it must be like to suspect that your child might have been lynched. And so with those questions, and also having spent 4 years filming in communities where people were looking at historical lynchings, looking at how they can memorialize the victims and what they can do for justice and repair, I went to Bladenboro and was really struck by the similarities between the communities where I'd been filming and what was going on there, the nightmare that Claudia and other people were facing.
Well, so you'd already been filming things that we see. Like, for instance, there are reenactments of a terrifying lynching in this area, the 1946 Moores Ford lynching. Two black couples at Moores Ford Bridge in Georgia in 1946 pulled out of their cars by a white mob, Ku Klux Klan mob. I mean, it's just horrific. There are reenactments of this. In fact, we hear from one of the reenactors, a black woman, who is sort of re-traumatized as she reenacts something that's in the area's history.
It makes me feel empowered, because I'm helping to hopefully bring some closure to what happened with these families.
And we also meet in your film the daughter of a Klansman who was taken to a lynching as a child.
It was hard to believe that that was really my dad and his friends that I knew that ate fish and hush puppies at the house. But it was. It was the same people.
Olivia Taylor was, she was new to the reenactment and had come to consult about the costumes that they were using of the Klansmen. And because her father was one of the leaders of the Klan in Stone Mountain, Georgia, she understood what their authentic dress should look like. And as she worked with them, she decided for the first time in her life to act and to play one of the roles in the reenactment.
But it's so fascinating because you have these reenactors and their story of, you know, what to some might be ancient history. You know, you show people debating, not just white townspeople, but black as well, saying, why are we doing this reenacting? Why are we, you know, bringing this up again? Let history rest. And meantime, you have Claudia Lacey saying, it's not history. I think it happened to my son.
That's right. And Claudia has always, from the very beginning, wanted answers, whether or not Lennon committed suicide or whether or not he was lynched. She wanted to know, and she didn't want just a cursory investigation, but she wanted people to give her evidence. And she's never felt like the officials showed up for that case, for Lennon's death, in an appropriate way, given the history of lynching in this country. This film is really about the lessons that we miss when there's cover-up and there's silence and denial around this history. And it's also about how this violence has evolved today. And so it's really, for me, very clearly played out in Bladenboro.
Well, for you, very clearly. And frankly, as someone who's watched the film, it seems very clear. This young man went off to play a football game. That night he had a lot going for him. And the next day he shows up hanging from a swing set. We hear from a mortician who says there were bruises on his arms. He fought someone off. Yet we hear from white officials, FBI, that, no, we've investigated and it's a suicide. And then suddenly there's another storyline, another thread emerges, which is that Lennon Lacey, who's 17 and black, is dating the 32-year-old white mother of three who lived just a few yards from Lennon's home in a hard-scrabble trailer with a white couple who seemed pretty shaky and shady. I mean, they were called drug dealers. We see home video of them encouraging boys to fight. It's sort of like a fight club that they're running. And they hated that Lennon was dating this white woman, Michelle, who was living with them. After he's found hanged, they disappear. The trailer, completely gone. The implication is they did this.
Sure. Well, that aspect of it, and we looked at for a while I was weighing whether or not to take a more investigative reporting approach, a more whodunit approach, and it was kind of a rabbit hole that I was measuring, like, how far do I go down?
Right.
But what I realized is that what's really important to convey, short of having an answer, which I never found about exactly what happened to Lennon, although there's lots of information that came up out of the community.
Well, for instance, when Lennon was found hanging, he was wearing completely different shoes than when he left the house that night. They weren't his. They were two sizes is too small.
That's right. Claudia's always insisted that that's important evidence that should be considered didn't feel like it was adequately addressed.
So we're left with this question and this, you know, it seems like thoughtful people on both sides, you know, people who say this is a mother who just didn't want to see that her black son was too young to be dating a 32-year-old white and somewhat hard woman, and they broke up, and that's what broke his heart, and others saying it's clearly evidence of a lynching, a modern-day lynching. And in fact, you have activists who point out that there are other, quote-unquote, suicides of young black men that their families also don't think were suicides.
That's one of the parallels between the past and the present. Historically, less than 1% of the nearly 5,000 documented cases of lynchings ever went to trial for murder. And when investigators, historically and currently, when they don't appropriately investigate these cases, then the community, historically and currently in Bladenboro, are left with rumors, speculations, and stories. And all of that information, all of the speculation about Dewey Sykes and Carla Hudson.
Those were the white neighbors living in the trailer.
Yes. And Michelle and all those stories, that will start to dissipate over generations.
And do you know, Jacqueline Olive, if the FBI, if the town officials ever sought out Dewey and Carla and Michelle, the white people in the trailer next door?
I don't know if they did. I reached out to the chief of police, the medical examiner's office, the coroner, the district attorney, and other officials, and none of them would talk. And we ultimately submitted a FOIA request to the FBI and received a 10-page redacted summary that didn't really give us enough details to know who they talked to and what specifically they based their decision on.
Well, I have to say, I was so struck by the opening image of your film. It's a tight shot of a clothespin, and then we see a laundry line, an image to replace maybe the others that we're going to see. But we know immediately this is about a mother's love, you know, a mother hanging her laundry.
Absolutely. And how do you live with this? And how not just does Claudia live with this, but how do communities move forward is really, I think, the broader question. And it's something that is equally as important as finding out absolutely what happened to Lennon.
Jacqueline Olive, director of the documentary Always in Season about the death of Lennon Lacy. His family feels it was a lynching. It was ruled a suicide. And the history of lynching. It airs on PBS stations tonight. For more, go to herenow.org. Jackie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin, for having me.
President Trump had a simple message today at a massive rally in Ahmedabad, India.
America loves India. America respects India. And America will always be faithful and loyal friends to the Indian people.
The president spoke in front of more than 100,000 people. You could hear him there. It was the world's largest cricket stadium, and he stood alongside India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi, a popular but controversial figure that President Trump has embraced. Milan Vaishnav is director of the South Asia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Milan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
And you could hear those crowds. We know the president loves that kind of attention, but what's really drawing Trump to make this 8,000-mile trek right now?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. I think the first is that this president in the United States and Prime Minister Modi in India share a strategic convergence in terms of the potential threat that China poses, not just to the regional order in the Asia Pacific, but also to the global order around the world. And I think that's really what unites them in this unprecedented rally on Indian soil. But I think the president also has a couple of other more personal or political motivations. I mean, this is in some sense a vanity project. You'll recall that in September of last year, Prime Minister Modi spoke to a crowd of 50,000 Indian Americans in Houston, Texas. And I think President Trump took one look at that and said, you know, I want one of those too.
And he got it.
and he surely did. And it was twice as big. But the second thing is actually domestic politics here in the United States. He feels that by standing shoulder to shoulder with Prime Minister Modi in India, that is going to allow him and the Republican Party to win over Indian American votes, which have traditionally voted heavily Democratic come this November.
Okay, you've made a lot of great points. We're going to tick through a couple of them, starting with China. I want to play some more sound from the rally. Here is President Trump drawing a contrast between India and another country.
There is all the difference in the world between a nation that seeks power through coercion, intimidation, and aggression, and a nation that rises by setting its people free and unleashing them to chase their dreams. And that is India.
Is the unspoken country there that he's comparing to India a reference to China?
There's no question about that, Peter. One of the typically unspoken assumptions about this kind of budding U.S.-India partnership is that the U.S. really sees India as a potential balancer or hedge against a rising, aggressive, and expansionist China. Now, Indians also sometimes talk about China in the same way, although given that they share a 2,500-mile border, aren't as explicit about the Chinese threat, but that's sort of implicit in what has, in the world of geopolitics, really brought India and the United States together.
You also mentioned this idea that President Trump may be actually making a play at the Indian-American vote in this country. Why? Is it that powerful of a voting block?
Well, one thing we know about Indian Americans is that they are far above the median when it comes to education and when it comes to household wealth. They're literally off the charts. And that also means they're much more likely to vote. Now, historically, Indian Americans, who make up around 1% of the U.S. population, have voted overwhelmingly Democratic. However, Donald Trump thinks that he can win over some of those voters who care deeply about what's happening in India, and they want to see greater ties and bonds of friendship between the U.S. and India. I happen to think this quest is fundamentally misguided. Even if they were to switch sides, most Indian Americans are actually geographically clustered in blue states, so it probably wouldn't have much of an impact in the aggregate.
One of the other big issues hanging over this trip to India, of course, is the background of Prime Minister Modi. In fact, there were clashes over the weekend over that controversial new law that he supports, offering citizenship to certain immigrants who are not Muslim. Modi, of course, has also been blamed for anti-Muslim violence in the past. He is a Hindu nationalist. What do you make of the president embracing Modi?
Well, I think the president has a well-known penchant for strong leaders who may not feel as constrained as traditional leaders when it comes to the checks and balances of democratic governance. And Modi fits many of those characteristics. And I think, you know, from the prime minister's perspective, what Trump's visit does, in a sense, is gives him very valuable diplomatic air cover for controversial decisions he's taking at home that demonstrate a kind of pro-Hindu, sometimes an anti-Muslim bias that has received condemnation from a number of diplomatic quarters. But when you see the president and the prime minister sharing a stage and Trump heaping praise on Modi, that's obviously going to send a signal to the world that, you know, despite whatever's happening at home, the United States actually believes and backs Modi in a big way.
That's Milan Vaishnav, director of the South Asia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Milan, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks, Peter.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.